This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
The following talk was given by Professor Nahid Aslanbegi of Monmouth University for the PIGU mini-conference at Robinson College on the 29th of November 2013.
This paper, I just want to make clear that this is a co-authored paper and that it is part of a larger manuscript, which is a book on PIGU, which is coming out hopefully shortly within this year or next year. In the book, we have a structure which interprets the way PIGU worked, his intentions, and his view of economic policy. We think, and I can, I guess, name my co-author, Guy Oakes, and I, we think that PIGU was not primarily about designing specific policies, although people interpret him as having devised Piguvian taxes and subsidies to maximize economic welfare. We believe that he assessed welfare programs of his time, but he was very guarded in his judgments, and anybody who has read Pigou knows that he makes a lot of prima facie arguments, very guarded, qualifies his statements, and much of his analysis depends on the circumstances, economic circumstances, institutional contexts, the capacity of policymakers, whether they're good at policymaking, executing policies, and so on. David referred to the structure of Pigou's books repeatedly. That's also true of his articles, that he generally starts by saying the problem that is at issue has to be stated the following way, right? He corrects the way it has to be properly stated. Then he analyzes, right? And it's usually a cost-benefit, right? These are the costs, these are the benefits, and he rarely proposes policies of his own. It's mostly policies proposed by the new liberals, the Fabian socialists, or policies that other countries like Germany have adopted, whether it's labor policy, welfare policy. He's always, most of the time, he's analyzing other people's other proposals. So we think of him as a logician of policy analysis. He refers to himself as a logician, I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, in his inaugural address. So we don't think he wants to make specific policy. He wants to analyze policies. And this is also because he doesn't believe that an economist is a policymaker. He believes that statesmen, philosopher kings, make policy. They define priorities, and the economist adds his view of the equation, whatever the economic dimensions are, proposes his arguments to the statesman, and they will take these into consideration in addition to a lot of other considerations that they have to deal with, and then they make the decisions. So in terms of the return to gold, I think this is very important to remember. Another thing that people generally in the literature, present company excluded, do not refer to is the fact that Pigou is a historicist. That I don't think any of his generalizations are generalizations forever. They change as the economic circumstances change. So his conception of the validity of policy analysis is based on a shifting balance of interests, priorities, institutional capacities, power relations, and so on. And I would like to give an example which we do not go into in this paper, which has to do with the issue of capital levy, which was being discussed after the First World War in terms of how do you pay for the war debt. And I think the labor was arguing that there should be a one-time capital levy. So it would be on wealth, it could be on people who hold jewelry, on assets, which would pay off the debt, or a major part of the debt, and it would be over with. So you wouldn't have to tax people at very high rates over a number of decades. Immediately after the First World War, he was very much in favor of it, and he wrote some pamphlets on the levy. In 1924, by 1924, he had changed his mind. He believed that the political circumstances had changed, that there was not a general consensus on the levy, and it would be very difficult to execute it if there was not too much support for it. So his idea changed, and he assumed that now, given the political circumstances of 1924, you would be better off having a sinking fund, taxing and then paying off the debt over a number of years. And so the decision to return to gold, or the recommendation to return to gold, we see as a manifestation of this kind of thinking, that at the time, from the point of view of the circumstances at the time, Pigou was looking at what are the costs of returning to gold and what are the costs of not returning to gold. And that comparison for him had a specific answer at the time, but that would have changed in 1930, in hindsight. A lot of people look at the return to gold in terms of the consequences it had for workers, the British industry. But at the time he was looking at the issue, and I'm not thinking of every member of the Chamberlain-Bradbury committee, but from the point of view of this one person who was a member of the committee, he was aware of the cost of the return, but he was also very worried about the cost of not returning to gold. So, and that's what we lay out in the paper. In terms of the return to the cost of the return, and we have looked at documents that Pigou has was participated in writing, or wrote himself directly, which would be commission reports and a memoranda written for the government, and also a document that he prepared for the Brussels conference, the League of Nations conference in 1920. He was asked to prepare it, and this was an international conference that where I guess it was the first conference that the League of Nations has had proposed for the international disarray, to look at the international disarray in economic and financial conditions and see whether there would be some sort of a way to deal with it. And pamphlets and letters to the Times and so on. So we look at the contextual setting of the when Pigou was writing. In terms of the costs of the return to gold, and the return to gold here means return to gold at pre-war parity, which is 486. He does, in many of his writings, he's aware that these entail costs, and the costs would, and he repeatedly refers to them. That would be the fact that there would have to be deflation because the pound would be overvalued. There would have to be devaluation. And devaluation would mean that price deflation, prices would have to drop, and that means wages would have to drop. And in the context of the post-1917 October Revolution, everybody seemed to be very worried about labor unrest, and there had been quite a bit of labor unrest. There was a coal stoppage. I don't remember 1921 or 1920, the three-month coal strike. And there were millions of days lost to strikes. So he was quite cognizant of the fact that when you try to reduce wages, nominal wages, it would cost the labor markets quite a bit and the country quite a bit. And he refers to them. And when he specifies conditions under which the return to gold would have to be made, he's quite careful about saying we have to satisfy certain conditions before we return to it. And these conditions would be, as far as we can tell, is that fiscal policy would have to become responsible. So that means that you can't indefinitely print money, which would be quite inflationary. So the pre-war sound economic policy would have to be restored. Relative prices. And this is, and as far as I can tell, Pigou did not consider other countries so much. And he was mainly concerned with, and I think the committee, the Chamberlain-Bradbury Committee was mainly interested in relative prices, the American-British prices, and not so much what was happening in France or Italy and so on. So they believed that Pigou believed that the relative prices would have to be close to pre-war relative prices so that difference between the actual exchange rate and the pre-war parity would have to be within a 20% margin. Now, this is much lower than what Keynes, Hawtrey, and Horn wrote in 1922 for a general conference, which I think they identify 50%. That countries that were within 50% of range, they could return to their pre-war parity. Between 60 and 90%, they could go somewhere in between. And countries that had seen devastating devaluation would have to completely come up with a new exchange rate. For Pigou, the margin was 20%. And even when in September of 1924, they were within 10 to 12% of the pre-war parity rate. Pigou was uncomfortable, and he makes that statement that he's in favor of waiting and seeing what happens. In fact, I think there is a paper, Brian Redaway says that if the Labour government had not fallen in the October the general election, that the committee would have recommended waiting for another year and reassessing the situation in another year. And at that time, they would have seen that the margin was very wide, and therefore they would have delayed the situation again. Well, of course, these are all counterfactuals. The Labour government fell, and the Conservative government came into power. And the mere speculation that the Conservative government would return to gold strengthened the pound, and the margin was something like 10 to 12%. But they were still waiting. In January, then the margin had been within, I think it was 2%, below 2%, 1.5%. So that was within a comfort zone, at least for Pigou, that the cost of adjustment would not be too high. So relative prices would have to be closer. That means the exchange rate margins would have to be very small. And then the economy would have to be able to cover its immediate payment obligations by creating enough revenue. So it would have to have export revenue. It would have to have, I guess, if there are investment revenues from other countries, they would have to be larger than the amount of money spent on imports, the money that leaves. So current account balance would have to be in good shape. And he was in favor of, he thought that if they were going to return to gold, they would have to have capital controls so that they would be able to keep the money inside the economy. So he has specific conditions under which he wanted to, that the economy could return to gold. And I think when you look at the situation of the country, and the report itself says that in January of 1925, these conditions did satisfy. The cost of not returning to gold, which would be maintaining the status quo, for Pigou, the costs were very large. One was that you lose the adjustment mechanism of the gold standard. Now, how far the gold standard, how well this adjustment mechanism functioned. Of course, people, scholars have said that before World War I they functioned, but it was just because of a unique set of circumstances that it may not have been repeated after the war. But they worked with the data they had at the time, so they couldn't see, they didn't have enough data to work on. That the adjustment mechanism repaired the imbalances in trade, credit, prices, and so on. That's something that you would lose if you maintained the status quo. He was very worried about unlimited credit issue. That unlimited credit issue would keep interest rates low, and he believed that the capital markets were, the real capital markets were where the loanable funds would be generated for reconstruction of the economy. And if you issued too much credit, interest rates would be artificially low, and the Ramsey intergenerational, intertemporal saving decisions will be out of kilter. So low interest rates would make people give people the incentive to borrow a lot more than they would save, and it would also lead to other countries borrowing from the British much more, so we would lend more to other countries than we normally would have. Unlimited currency issue would mean unlimited paper currency issue and uncontrollable inflation, and he was very worried about Austria, Germany, France, Italy. But and there was, of course, after the war, a 1 year of extreme boom where prices were increasing quite fast. He was very worried about that. And the inflation rate, the high inflation rates for him were unfair because they would distribute income from the general populace to the government, from people who received fixed dividends to people who owned normal stocks. They eroded the purchasing power of salaries and wages, and he believed that this would create great friction. So in other words, the cost of maintaining the status quo did not mean price stability. It meant, for him, without controlling credit, it would mean that you would prices would increase and you would have workers striking for higher wages, and you would get instability in the labor markets. He also worried that there would be great depreciation in the currency, and there would be a loss of credibility for the currency. He distinguished between credibility of the currency and the credibility of the government, the trustworthiness of the government. Mm-hmm. If there was a lack of credibility of the currency, then people wouldn't want to hold it. Exchange rate would fluctuate quite a bit. Trade and exchange would be, for him, devastated. And he also worried that the depreciation could create its own momentum. Just like in development literature, if there is a population momentum, even if fertility rates drop, he believed that if you, even if the fiscal policy of the state became responsible, meaning they wouldn't issue credit so much or paper money, the currency might continue to depreciate, and that would mean that raising funds for future purposes would be become very difficult because interest rates would be much higher. There is a criticism that the committee did not consider devaluation very seriously as an option. Devaluation does not seem to be a serious option for anybody. Even in with the Macmillan Committee, I think they didn't recommend devaluation. Aside from the fact that the position, the international position of London was at stake and so on, Pigou believed that a devaluation would create more inflation. And it would be a loss of trust in the government. The issue of credibility was quite important to Pigou. Eiken Green, who has done this book on golden fetters, he says that devaluation and credibility were intimately linked, that credibility for the British was tantamount to having 486. As the exchange rate, the pre-war parity. The loss of credibility in the government for Pigou was quite important for a factor that other people did not mention, but he says in one of his government, in one of his testimonials to the government before the Committee on National Debt, that he is obsessed with the thought that there would be another war. And he estimates that there would be another war in 20 years, which he misses by about 5 years. And he also is very worried about developments in nuclear physics, that there would be, he doesn't say there would be a nuclear bomb, but he says there would be, these developments could lead to instruments of war that would annihilate people and so on. So the next war for him could be of fantastic dimensions, and you could not fight a war by taxing people the same way that you couldn't do it in the First World War. You wouldn't be able to do it in the Second World War, and you would have to raise money, and raising money would mean that the government would necessitate a credible government. Otherwise, they would not be able to borrow money. So that he wanted to restore credibility to the government, which meant that devaluation was not a good option. But other options would be a non-gold standard system. He says that he has always been, and you can find actually evidence in his work that he was for stable prices, staying away from gold, a Fisherian system of maintaining price stability, or a what came out in the Brussels conference or in the general conference of the gold exchange standard system, where one or two currencies would be connected to gold and everything else would be connected to those currencies, as sort of a Bretton Woods, precursor of a Bretton Woods system. But for Pigou, all of these were impracticable, that you could not execute these policies, and that it was, because the institutional structure was not there, you don't have central banks, you wouldn't be able to coordinate credit policy, and if there is no what he called general assent meaning consensus, there is no general consensus about these things, then you would not be able to adopt this policy. The general consensus would have to come from the public, that the people would have to understand it and agree to it, and also politicians. And not just domestically, it would have to be internationally. If at the General Conference and at the Brussels Conference people saw that systems other than gold would not be practicable, then one country going on its own and everybody else returning to gold would not work. And in fact, in reality, you saw that a lot of countries went back to gold within the 1923 to 1927 framework. So I would like to read the conclusion of the paper. Not so... one of the some of what Pigou did with the gold standard depends on Pigou's view of economic policy making. That in order to for policy to work, it has to be within a certain paradigm so that people are familiar with it, they agree to it, both politicians and the larger public. Unlike Keynes, he was profoundly suspicious of intellectually clever innovations in the political sphere. So there is a fundamental difference between Pigou and Keynes in terms of the function of how you make policy, who makes policy, and whether it would work. I read the same passage that you reread in the paper. He says, on the main issue, which is one of practical politics rather than economics, whether the government should take the plunge now or denounce no renewal of the embargo, I'm only just in favor of a wait-and-see policy. It would be very inappropriate for me as an academic person to press for heroism. But if the rest of the committee had been in favor of it, I doubt if I should have opposed. We think that this is very consistent with our view of his economic policy making, that as an academic economist, he did not think that it was appropriate for him to push for not returning to gold. He believed that the policymakers had already made the decision to return to gold and to return to gold at the pre-war parity rate. So in many years, in I think 1947 or 1948, when he writes his economic history book, he publishes an economic history book, he says, if there was a mistake in the return to gold, that mistake was not a mistake of economic analysis. It was a mistake of it was a politician's mistake. People deciding that they would have to go return to gold. I don't think he takes any responsibility for the recommendation. Once politicians had decided that the country should return to gold, it was a question of whether they return to gold now or 6 months later or a year later. And the economic costs that came with it were just a means to accomplishing a goal that the government had already decided.